Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swayer and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical applications that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
And as usual, views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours alone, do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And with that lovely bit of depressing bit, so let's talk about something more exciting. Do you want to talk about phishing tests?
Not only more exciting, but something that's sure to make all this sound worthwhile.
Yeah, this is just a home run.
All right, so the next article is research. Simulated phishing tests make organizations less secure. And this comes to us from Security Week. So a large-scale, long-term phishing experiment was conducted at an organization that has 56,000 employees. And this was conducted by ETH Zurich. And the English translation is the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, which is one of the top 10 universities in the world. What they found was that phishing simulations and phishing education in the corporate environment may make employees more susceptible to phishing versus less susceptible. In a 15-month period, ETH Zurich partnered with this 56,000 employee company to do simulated phishing emails, including the report phishing button, where they would send these test simulations to employees. They could report it or not and possibly click on links or open attachments to those emails. What they found was 32% of participants clicked on at least one link or attachment in simulated phishing emails. And even a higher number of actions took place where you had, or not a higher number, but a similarly high number of dangerous actions like putting in credentials, et cetera, was at 25.43%. Where at least one individual had performed those actions. Their conclusion from that was eventually employees will fall for a fish if continually exposed to that fish.
I don't know that that's really a groundbreaking thing. I mean, that's considered a truism pretty much these days, right?
I would agree with that. But that's not the key takeaway from the paper. And actually the article is not, I would say there's some issues with the article getting to the actual heart of the matter as outlined in the paper.
Yeah, before we started, I asked David, I was like, this article doesn't say what the headline of the article says, right?
Yeah, you actually have to go to the paper, Matt said the link is in the sixth paragraph. So it's like almost towards the bottom of the article. But the link will be in the show notes as well. And it's not terribly long. It's only 18 pages. And it's well indexed, so you can jump to the section that talks about the actual challenges with conducting the phishing emails. But in the paper, they found that both click and dangerous action rates were higher for participants that received the phishing emails and the contextual training with those emails. So you may or may not have participated in this type of training, but many phishing training or phishing simulation training that takes place in corporate environment, they will send you an email that, you know, attempts to convince you to click on a link or open an attachment. And when you do those things, you will then be sent to a on-the-spot training or remedial training for identifying a phishing email saying, hey, you've made a mistake. This was a phishing email. You shouldn't have clicked on the thing, or you should not have opened the attachment. Here's some remedial training so you don't do this in the future. And what they found was after people fell for the fish and clicked on it, out of the test group and the control group, in the test group, 3,593 people would click on it, versus 3,087 in the control group. And for dangerous actions, it was 2,730 would perform the dangerous action versus the 2,155 in the control group, showing that Matt, you had done the math on this, but I didn't, on the percentage difference between these two.
Well, I was actually looking at a different number. This difference is a little less than a third between the two. I was looking at a different set of numbers in the paper where it talked about.
In the next section, we were talking about the participants that clicked on two or more phishing emails.
Oh, that was two or more. All right. Yep. Yep.
So in the control group, it was 647 versus 801 that had done the training.
Yeah. Okay. So both click and danger sections for falling for simulated phishing, 3,000 versus 3,600. So that's actually about 20% too. Although the second one is 600 over 2,200, which is about, which is between a third and it's like 27%. Obviously somebody listening to me like, you're totally wrong. So those kind of match up with the 20%.
Yeah. Which I don't think is insignificant. 20% may not sound like a lot, but it seems that's a pretty sizable number.
This is just so contrary to common sense and like what you would think that this is a pretty stunning result. And this is, and it's all the more suspicious because it's only one study that says this. And when you have a study that comes up with a result that's the opposite of what it should be, you should definitely pay attention to the study. But I think the next step here is before anybody starts changing anything, I think it's time to start looking at more studies. Because there may be something about these groups. The groups were not enormous. I mean, 14,000 is not small, but depending on how you chose the people in that group, it might be that, you know, the 14,000 included the entire marketing department or the entire HR department. Were they randomly chosen across the company?
Mm-hmm. Probably, yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't see that in the paper, but I could have missed it. But with the paper came away from the conclusion of the paper, though, wasn't that initially phishing simulation was bad and you're better off not doing it. What they think is the issue is the way that the training is done may be what is the problem, not necessarily the phishing simulation or the training itself, but how it was conducted.
Yeah. So they did randomly select the users, although they found that the users, though the people in their study had a high, so they sorted them by things like age range and by gender and by how often they use computers. But I don't see comparisons here on things like, so for example, the number of employees in that 14,000 person experimental group. So over somewhere just under half of them were infrequent users of computers. And somewhere around a quarter of them were between the ages of 50 and 59. So infrequent user of computers and older typically kind of matches with what I've seen in terms of susceptibility to phishing. So now again, there's 18 pages, maybe they address that. So maybe they map that to what the control group was like. And if the control group was also tended to be older and more infrequent user, or if the control group, because when you do a random distribution, you can still end up with weird and wacky results. In terms of your random, you may have randomly chosen older people.
Yeah, but you know, and to your point, and I think you, and this is a good one, that they're looking at it from the wrong perspective, trying to say that, you know, what biological factors lead people to being susceptible to fish versus how do these people fit within the organizational structure as to whether they're more susceptible to phishing or not, because it could be not based on their biology, but the nature of the position which they hold within the company means their risk tolerance or the necessity for them to click on links or attachments may differ. And I think we've talked about this before where, you know, if you're in HR or you're in marketing or you're in customer service, your interactions and your expectation to get attachments and links and emails from unknown people differs. So if they did this study and found that, like you're saying, the marketing department, and maybe that's a bad example, but let's say HR who receives email or emails with
PDF attachments,
PDF attachments for, you know, job applications or whatever. So maybe that group had increased likelihood of falling for phishing where attachments were there. And customer service reps were more likely to fall for email that had, or phishing emails that had links in them. I think that is probably a better analysis versus going to the biological, which is just simpler, versus coming up with an organizational structure and saying, oh, well, this group, based on their role within an organization, is going to be more susceptible than this group, and maybe tailoring the training to suit that.
Yeah, so they had a really cool table at the top of page 3 that actually kind of describes some of these things, and they break down into their findings that match with what's previously been seen and the new findings. So one of the things that they mentioned is age and computer skills correlate with phishing susceptibility, which is kind of what I mentioned, although they found that older and younger employees were more at risk versus the people in the middle, which kind of makes sense. You know, younger people may not, with their personal accounts, especially like Google does a really good job of stripping out spam. People that are just starting working may not recognize those phishes yet. They found a really weird finding where the type of computer use is more predictive for phishing vulnerability than the amount. They found that people who use the computer daily for repetitive tasks with specialized software only are most vulnerable. And that's interesting, but that makes sense because people that use it for a specialized task are probably trained to use the computer in one specific way. They don't necessarily have general computer use skills. So I can see that's kind of like the HR example. Like if an HR person is supposed to be receiving emails with resumes, then of course they're going to get caught by every phishing email that consists of an attachment that looks like a resume. So some of those findings make sense. But I think the general takeaway from this is just confirmation that you cannot trust users. You should treat users' computers as potentially compromised.
I would say not trusting users is probably not the right way to put it. So much as to say that, you know, people are human, you know, and they all have the same susceptibilities regardless of, you know, who they are.
Yeah, you basically just have to treat each endpoint like it could be compromised at any time and be ready to throw those walls around it.
Right.
Or block access or whatever.
We may have talked about this before where you say, you know, the security may be everybody's job, but it's not what people in HR are focusing on when they're doing their work. You know, they are there to do HR work. They're not.
Yeah, if you're paying them to do security, you're wasting your time, you're wasting your money, and you're making your business less effective.
Right. So temper your expectations accordingly.
Next article is stealing more SRE ideas for your stock from Anton Chivakin, whose name I probably mispronounced yet again. I was thinking about this. I tend to go to the same wells over and over again, and he's one of them, and Daniel Meisler is the other. So maybe I should start trying to branch out a little more next year. But I swear this will be our last. This will be our first Anton article for the year. Anyway, so this is another article from Anton Chivakin on easing SOC issues, especially around automation. And what he did here is he went through a book on site reliability engineering from Google, looking for ideas on how to do automation in the SOC. The main idea he pulled from there is that the factors of consistency, quickness, and reliability dominate most conversations about the trade-offs of performing automation. And rather than try to walk, this is a fairly dense article, rather than try and walk through every single point, I pulled out 5 quotes to kind of discuss with David that I thought were super interesting and really kind of discuss some of the pros and the cons of automation, because very few people talk about the cons of automation, but definitely worth talking about. So the first quote, and I think these are actually quotes from the SRE book. They're in the Anton article, but they're from the SRE book. First one is, once you have encapsulated some task in automation, anyone can execute the task. And the main takeaway here is that this is the eternal problem in security, right? Is having people that are good at their job, people that you can trust to, you know, update a firewall's rule set, people that you can trust, update signatures, block proxies without blocking everything. And automations in some ways make that easier, but also make it easier for people to screw up. But we'll talk about that in a minute. So by having something automated, now you have the skill set to deploy that to all of your employees.
Yeah, you don't have to rely on the more senior folks to do some of these types of tests like you're talking about, which are, you know, easy in concept, but more challenging in execution.
Yeah. The problem that automation doesn't address, though, is knowing which things to block. I mean, I'm sure pretty much everybody that's ever worked in security for long enough has some story about being asked to block internal IP addresses. Like, I think I've heard it from just about everybody, you know, some young security analyst, some new security analyst sends through a request to block the 10.0.0.0/8 subnet because there's bad stuff coming through there. I know I heard a story when I was working as a government contractor about when somebody in the Army requested or tried to put in a firewall block for 127.0.0.1, which frankly, with the firewalls, probably wouldn't have done anything. But still, like, that's embarrassing. Or maybe it was EDR. It may have been HIPS. It may have been trying to block stuff in HIPS from going to 127.0.0.1, which would have had more of an impact if something was trying to connect to itself. But
yeah, host-based firewall, that would have been much more dangerous.
Yeah. But it's interesting because this does allow you to have your most junior analyst, you know, work at the same efficiency level in terms of blocking things or mediating things or running commands as your most senior analysts. They just lack sometimes the knowledge of which one to use and what's the correct one to use. So I don't know if this is a pro or a con.
What this allows for is the validation of the automation task one time versus the validation of the individual task each time that it gets done. Because you could have a junior engineer do this or a good junior analyst do the block every time, but there'd be a level of validation you have to do each time for that task. And you were talking about the blocking of the wrong IPs, whether it be internal or external. But if you spend a lot of time on validating that task that can be automated to put in, you know, the block workflow to say, okay, block IP, you know, it's kind of like writing a program, you know, do this, accept this, or do this if this. And having that entire flow built out to say, you know, if it's this, then don't proceed, or if it's this, proceed, you know, and go down that step when you build the automation task.
I was just thinking about, like, how do you build in some checks in there? And the easiest and most obvious one is you build in a manual check where it flicks up to a medium or a senior level analyst for validation. And yeah, that's definitely more work, but it's still less work than somebody going in and manually adding something. Because a senior analyst might be able to just look at it and maybe include like the metadata, like who owns the net block and, or, you know, what's the DNS information or something like that. And a senior analyst might be able to be like, yes or no.
I think that's a good way to start your automation journey anyway, to automate the thing, but don't let it execute until someone's reviewed it. And then the button can be clicked to do the execution.
Yeah. And then you can start hard coding things in there. Like, you can hard code like never block 10.0.0.0/8.
Right.
Never block these things. Yeah. But that's a lot more work. But again, it's probably still less work than going in and manually doing things.
Yeah. Cause imagine if you do all it, really it's talking about where do you do the work at? You know, do you do all the work up front or do you do it over the entire, you know, the entire time, like every time that task runs?
Yeah. Yep. So, and speaking of, you mentioned the centralization part. So the next quote was, a platform also centralizes mistakes. In other words, a bug fixed in the code will be fixed there once and forever. The good, of course, is that if the mistakes are centralized, you only have to find them and fix them once, as it mentions. The bad, of course, is that if you had, you know, 20 different firewalls and 20, you know, 10 different firewall manufacturers across your environment, you had to go out and manually do it, and you made a mistake once, that mistake only existed in one of those firewalls. If you have a mistake in your firewall blocking automation where it doesn't actually block it, now you may have been not blocking stuff for days, months, years without realizing it. So, and this is a common problem with SIEM content too. If a SIEM content rule never fires, is that because the bad thing didn't happen, or is that because the content doesn't work?
Yeah, it's kind of goes back to, you know, the early question in law to say, is it better to let an innocent man go free? Is it better to make a let a bad man go free than to sentence an innocent man? So yeah. It's, you know, which way do you fall on which is better? Mm-hmm. As whether you're going to risk doing that at a centralized place or not.
Yeah, and it seems like the answer is actually very similar as well to the SIM question. And it's basically has to do with verify, trust but verify. You can, if you have an automation tool, you can probably create some way to test those automations. Someone runs an automation to block something. Maybe you set up an automation to run 24 hours later to check and see if it was blocked.
Yeah, it depends on how the mistake is.
Yeah, that's fair. But you could at least try to push it through the firewall and respond back with, you know, the packet was dropped, therefore it was actually blocked, or the packet was allowed, therefore someone's in trouble.
Right. Well, like I said, it part of it though is, you know, the nature of the mistake, because maybe it does what you expect and more. So it blocks what you expected to block, but it blocks things you didn't expect it to block, you know, and that's harder to test for, testing the unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
But I think what can make this more palatable would be the accompanied process to remediate mistakes. You know, so if you make a mistake, that's a broad, you know, if you make a mistake in the code, which has broad implications, you know, what is your process to remediate or roll back that mistake? And is it quick and effective? Because if you also validate that process, then maybe people are less concerned because they know the mistake would be short-lived and easily corrected.
It works. Next quote. Automation needs to be careful about relying on implicit safety signals. And this is actually kind of related to what we were talking about before with the automatic blocking, but it goes with other things as well. You mentioned, I think, before we started talking, there was a part in the article where they talked about at least one large company who automatically remediated uninfected systems remediated by wiping the hard drive and degassing the hard drive. which is a pretty aggressive, but this is kind of, I've never seen a company actually go full on automated remediation, mostly because of this. Like, if you have some sort of programmatic mistake in there, then you're going to push that photographic mistake out everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of trust, you know, because people have to trust the automation. And how long does it take for that trust to accumulate or to build? You know, you could build the automation and run it for a year and without error, and it errs one time, and then immediately people want to rip out the automation. That year did not build up the level of trust necessary. So I think part of your journey to automation needs to be reinforcement that the automation is working regularly and consistently, and people know this. And because if it's running in the background for a year, people don't even really think about it anymore. And then it makes a colossal mistake that screws everything up. People automatically want to rip it out. Might be because they have not been informed that this has run 1,200 times without mistake before.
Yeah.
So I think part of that, your automation needs to be some mechanism to report the successfulness of the automation as it takes place as well.
Yeah. And that... You also need leadership that will accept that, especially if they can explicitly accept it, would be best, and, you know, written and documented form. That let's say you want to automate a credential reset based on an alert saying that an account's been compromised. You have to look at that and say, all right, what is the true positive rate of this? If it's, you know, 80% true positives and 20% of them are going to be false positives, but we believe that this will prevent, you know, 5 attackers. Like, if we look over our instance from last year and this would have slowed down 5 attackers, then someone's got to make that explicit call. Like, all right, I am willing to accept that, you know, 15 people will be inconvenienced by this. And in return, we'll stop 5 attackers from gaining access because we were able to reset their passwords faster. You know, maybe it takes the help desk 10 hours or something. And we can just, boom, do it automatically. So I think any of the automated remediation stuff, for sure, you have to have that explicit risk discussion, and you have to get the sign off from your CEO or CIO or CISO or whatever the appropriate level is.
Yeah, it's the exact same conversation we've had before about IDS, you know, and turning off alerts and things of that nature. It's a risk acceptance model.
Yeah. Next quote, automation that is crucial, but only executed at infrequent intervals and therefore difficult to test, is often particularly fragile because of the extended feedback cycle. The example they use there is something like phishing, which happens all the time and you have to do a lot of review of. And, you know, analysts may see multiple times a day. The development cycle and the feedback cycle is super quick. You roll out a new playbook, and the very next day, someone's going to run through that playbook 5 times, and they're going to find 6 errors, and they're going to send them to you and be like, hey, fix all this stuff now. If the playbook runs once a month, you're going to build a playbook. It's going to run sometime, you know, 1 to 30 days later. Then you're going to fix it if there's any feedback, and then it's going to run 1 to 30 days later. But then on the other hand, we've talked about this before in the past, you've got to weigh how much time savings there is in that automation and whether it's worth it to do it or not. I know I spoke with OneSoc doing automation and asked them about, you know, did you try to create automated playbooks for everything, or do you try to create automated playbooks? Like, how do you handle all these edge cases? And what they explicitly told me in terms of automation was they're looking at the 80-20 rule. They're trying to do the 20% of automation that will handle 80% of the cases. And when it's an edge case, they just fall back to manual. What they did was they automated all of their actions. They automated like blocking stuff at the firewall, you know, changing credentials, putting a system into a containment VLAN, like all kinds of remediation and investigative options. And then they just made those all available to the user as scripts or something, buttons maybe. I don't know what tool specifically they were using. Then they relied on the analyst to make the decision. And then the automation was performing specific actions. The automation was not, you know, trying to make the decision on whether to action it or not. That was the user. That was the analyst.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to go about it, because you're still saving a lot of time. Mm-hmm. By reducing those actions down to button pushes or whatever. Yeah.
The biggest problem there, though, is while you are saving time, you're still not addressing like the skills gap. Can't take a completely inexperienced analyst and throw them into a situation like that and have them necessarily make the correct decisions all the time. That's a problem no matter what. This automation doesn't solve that problem. Automation will ease it because you'll save so much time. You know, you won't take 5 or 10 minutes to open up a web page and put in your proxy block or whatever. It'll take you 10 seconds instead. So you'll definitely save time. You'll be able to spend more time doing the more interesting investigative part, but it's not a panacea, if that's how you pronounce it.
Panacea.
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 Is it really? Damn it.
Yeah, panacea.
See, I thought about that, and I thought that sounds ridiculous. Panacea sounds better, but
it doesn't have the panache.
Doesn't have the panache. No, it does not. Any specific thoughts on that? The extended intervals and the.
Well, I had 2 thoughts on it. So the first thought was that, you know, talking about the life cycle and the extended feedback, really, it made me think of the difference between agile and waterfall. When you're talking about project or development, where agile is fail fast, fail often, which is the shorter cycle, rapid development. Then you have waterfall, where you have a lot more time and then execute and then possibly fail. And then you have to go back and redo that whole thing that's how long it's been a longer period before you realize the mistake that was done a while back. So it's very similar to the difference there. And you'd see the advantages of that shorter cycle and why people prefer to do agile versus waterfall now. And as far as, you know, the skills gap, I think you could probably rank or label the executions based on how dangerous they are and then assign only certain levels of analysts to do certain actions, even with the automation.
Yeah.
Or you could have it so you have to have a dual agreement. So maybe one senior analyst or two junior analysts have to agree and then execute the action or something like that.
Yeah, the Four Eyes protocol they used to do in the military, where two people had to look at and confirm something before they would action it. That's forensics.
Nuclear missile launches?
No, that's forensics. I learned that in the forensics class. I think one of the SANS forensics classes, they talked about Four Eyes protocol, where just two people had to review everything before they accepted it as true.
Hmm.
I don't remember what the specific context was. It wasn't just, you know, like everything gets reviewed by two people. There was something forensics related.
Hmm. But, yeah, so again, there was some kind of bar that said, you know, yep, if this, then, you know, you had to do this kind of validation.
All right. And the final one is the most functional tools are usually written by those that use them. And that one is always, this has actually been a longstanding argument that I've had. And I'll use the automation people as an example. Where in the security organization does the automation engineer reside? Do they reside in the SOC, or do they reside in the engineering team, or do they reside outside of the security team with the rest of the programmers, you know, in some sort of IT or software development team? And in my opinion, the answer to that is should be the SOC. It should be ideally, if you can't, you know, if you don't have SOC staff yourself who are programmers and can be writing these automation playbooks, which is ideal, they still need to be sitting next to them every day as close as possible to the action, because otherwise they do not understand, you know, the limitations. They don't necessarily understand the information you need. This is something when I reviewed automation products a couple years ago, I found was a huge issue. None of the automation products presented the information in the way that I cared about it. They didn't present, you know, the pieces of information that I thought were most important for trying to determine if a domain was phishing or not, because I don't think any of them were written by SOC analysts. Now, they had all consulted SOC analysts, but they weren't themselves SOC analysts.
Yeah, that's really hard because usually SOC analysts don't have that skill set.
No, they don't. Which is why you usually hire somebody else as your automation engineer. And then that kind of gets to the question of where this automation engineer should be. Should they be in the SOC or should they be in the engineering team?
Maybe you should look at a longer term investment to say, yeah, we're gonna hire an automation engineer, but they're going to spend a year doing analyst work and they're going to have to know that and accept that that's how they're going to spend their first year.
Interesting. Hire somebody with a programming background, and rather than trying to make a SOC analyst into an automation person, make an automation person into a SOC analyst.
Right. The challenge there is you have to get them to accept the soul crushing SOC work for a year.
You know, I don't think they would need a year, but yeah, a couple months for sure. That'd be really interesting to actually, and then have them kind of work the incidents, like as they're working on the playbook. Like maybe you don't have to have them do it all for 3 months or a year, but like if your first playbook is going to be phishing, you have them sit for, you know, a month and do phishing incidents and work with your analysts on doing the phishing incidents. And then they write the playbook and then they keep doing the incidents while they're working the playbook and constantly making updates to it. Of course, that'd run afoul of change management in a lot of places, but.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I know that's another battle that I fought is keeping automation tools under change management. When you want to, you know, if you discover a logic issue with an automation tool and you've got to go through a change board and you've got to submit tickets and all that kind of stuff is a real pain.
Yeah, if you get the, you know, I've talked to, you know, SRE engineers before, and, you know, what they, you know, big proponents of were they, support is that you get the process approved and then that is what is actually audited. But once the process is approved, you can do anything within that process without change management or change control. So if you have a solid process that's been approved to say that you make this change in the script, it automatically goes to testing. It has to pass testing before it can get into production or, you know, all those checks that are in there. And change management has approved that process, then the process is what gets audited and checked and not the individual changes that take place within the process.
So that's almost another level of abstraction on top of a standard change, where standard changes are automatically approved unless there's a reason not to. Like in this case, you're not even submitting the individual changes at all. Or you're documenting them somehow.
But well, you can automate, if you can get them approved as a standard change, but then automate the standard change also.
Yeah.
So the changes created, executed, and then closed automatically as part of the process as well. So that when you say that the process has been approved, you can approve that as a standard change. Automation and this concept of SRE is fantastic and really needs to be looked at more closely by SOX.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff that I'm finding from other groups like manufacturing, looking at like the Toyota Business System and the concepts of visual management and things like that, and manufacturing operations. A lot of that's applicable to SOC. Like, there's just so much stuff from other places that we're not using because everybody in security has come up from IT. Like we don't have that cross-pollination. And site reliable engineering is a pretty new thing. So we don't have that necessarily cross-pollination either.
All right, well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your podcast app.